Welcome to AUSA's Army Matters podcast. This is Thought Leaders with Joe Craig. My guest today is Joseph Whelan, author of Bloody Okinawa, The Last Great Battle of World War II. Joseph Whelan is the author of 9 previous books, including the highly acclaimed books Terrible Swift Sword and Midnight in the Pacific. Before turning to writing books full-time, Whelan was a reporter and editor for the Associated Press for 24 years, and he lives in Cary, North Carolina. Joe, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So with the book, we've got, as you say, Bloody Okinawa as the last great battle of World War II. So I'd like to set the stage. And can you tell us what's been happening in the Pacific War and the months leading up to the battle?
Certainly. I'll take you back to the fall of 1944, when the United States invaded the Philippines, and same time, Battle of Peleliu. So during this period, we were advancing northward in the Western Pacific and the Central Pacific through the Philippines. So we went to Leyte, Luzon early in 1945. Mm-hmm. The next step was the Battle of Iwo Jima, which was a 6-week battle that began in mid-February 45. So now that brought us to Okinawa, which was called Operation Iceberg. And this was an important place because it was only 350 miles from mainland Japan, the southernmost part of it, Kyushu.
Right.
And so it would have been just the perfect place to launch the invasion of mainland Japan, which was planned for the fall of 45 and the spring of 46. So it was an important battle. It lasted 82 days.
Wow. And you know, as they prepared for the battle, you know, it was going to be the largest amphibious operation of the Pacific War. So you've got the soldiers and Marines getting ready, and they're expecting major opposition. But it turns out that most of them were able to simply walk ashore. So why didn't the Japanese fight on the beaches?
It was because of their shift in strategy. After the Mariana Islands fell in the summer of 1944, those were Saipan, Guam, and Tinian. Mm-hmm. Senior Japanese officers realized the war was lost and that the best they could do was to exact a high death toll from the Americans and perhaps force them to the bargaining table and to negotiate a peace and drop their demand for unconditional surrender. They thought that was the best they could do. Mm-hmm. So along that line, beginning with Peleliu, the Japanese no longer launched bonsai attacks at the water's edge, but they would shell the beachhead, they would shell the reef, but they would not launch bonsai attacks. They would let the Americans come to them, and they were in almost impregnable defenses inside the hills of those three islands, Okinawa, Iwo Jima, Peleliu. And indeed, they exacted a high cost. Peleliu, as many Americans became casualties as Japanese were killed. On Iwo Jima, there were something like 25,000 American casualties, 22,000 Japanese defenders were killed. So in that sense, it had become a successful strategy. And Okinawa, they were hoping to continue that trend, to kill as many Americans or wound them as there were defenders.
So can you describe some of the defenses that General Ushijima had prepared for the Americans?
He did not defend the beachhead, except with some maintenance troops from the airfields. It was very token. But 4 or 5 miles back to the south, he had fortified these ridges that ran east-west across the island. They're about 5 miles in width and 4 miles in depth. They were underground defenses, and so almost impermeable when it came to being softened up by American battleships, airstrikes, artillery, mortars. So that was the first line, the outer defensive line that they called it, was about 5 miles from the beachhead. Another few miles back was the main line, and that ran through a place they called Shuri Castle. It's a significant historical site on Okinawa. This is where the kings of the Ryukyu Islands had rained from. The main defensive line ran through Castle. And then farther back, there was another one, another fallback line that we didn't even know about. It was about 10 miles toward the south, almost on the southern tip of the island.
So you got on the American side getting ready to, they'll discover these defensive lines. You've got the commander of the 10th Army, General Simon Bolivar Buckner Jr. And his 10th Army's got a core of both Army and Marine divisions. Can you tell us what Buckner was like as a commander and what his general plan was for the campaign?
His plan was to attack these lines one after the other. He was not an imaginative commander, but he was pretty solid. There were some Marine generals and Army generals that wanted to launch a second landing on the southeast coast, but he didn't want to do that. Yeah, might have had very good reasons, because the landing site that they were talking about was commanded by some looming heights where the Japanese could put artillery, and it could have been a disaster.
Right. And I'm sure he's concerned about casualties too, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he was. He was casualty averse. And to his credit, actually, he believed that artillery, mortars, and tanks should soften up the targets before the infantry went in and accompany them. That as much supporting fire as he could bring to bear was a way to prosecute this campaign.
Right. So while they are fighting there in the waters surrounding Okinawa, you've got naval forces being under regular attack from kamikazes. Can you tell us what was happening there and how much pressure it put on Buckner?
Yes. Now, the Navy had set up these radar picket stations all around the island. There were 16 of them. And they were manned by a destroyer, which had the radar ship, and then a couple of other ships accompanying it. And they would direct planes from the aircraft carriers off the coast to intercept Japanese planes flying in from mainland Japan. They took horrendous casualties. The Japanese waves of them, there were 10, actually 10 mass attacks, suicide attacks, unprecedented, were aimed at the picket ships. And very few of them went for the big carriers and cruisers that were farther out.
Mm-hmm.
So the destroyers really took a toll. And the naval commander was pressuring Buckner to hurry to wrap this up. Nimitz, Admiral Nimitz, he was stationed in Guam at that time. He flew out to Okinawa and had a meeting and said, if this line isn't moving and within a certain number of days, I'm going to find someone else who will do it. So this led to one of the two major offensives, the Army and the Marines. So there was pressure on Buckner. And the Japanese just kept launching these massive air attacks at the Fifth Fleet, eventually sinking 36 warships and damaging over 300 others.
Right. So you're talking about the pressure that Nimitz is putting on Buckner and, back on the ground in Okinawa, or all too often in the mud, he and his soldiers are slogging it out, facing ridge after ridge of well-defended strongholds. So can you talk about some of the tactics, that excessive firepower that you referenced? How was that used to dig them out? And tell us about what was called processing and then corkscrew and blowtorch.
Oh, certainly. Yeah, those are the best tactics. Initially, they tried to overwhelm them with firepower because each U.S. division had like 5 to 6 times that of a Japanese division. But then they saw that they had to dig them out one by one, fortification by fortification, using corkscrew and blowtorch tactics. That's what they called them. Corkscrew being satchel charges, grenade, dynamite, C2, plastic explosives in the satchel charges, and the blowtorch being flamethrowers. Portable kind and the kind that was carried by tanks, too. They called them Zippos. So it was just a grind, just hill by hill. airstrikes and naval gunfire just seemed to have no discernible effect until the very end. In fact, the operation officer of the 32nd Japanese Army, Colonel Yahara, he was inside of the headquarters cave under Shuri Castle when they were being shelled heavily one time. And at the end of it, he said it sounded to him like the hum of cicadas. They were well fortified places.
Yeah, so the guys on the ground are expecting that no one could survive this kind of onslaught, but to their unpleasant surprise, they find out that the Japanese are quite well protected. So they are using a corkscrew and blowtorch and combined arms approach to get to the Japanese. But in the meantime, you've got a lot of Okinawan civilians kind of caught in between the two armies. What was it like for them?
It was terrible for them. Okinawa had more civilians living there than any other Pacific island that we were trying to capture, something like 450,000 civilians. And it wasn't that big of a place. It was 60 miles long, maybe average 5 or 6 miles wide. And most of the people lived in the south where the heaviest fighting was occurring. The civilians had been basically brainwashed by the Japanese into believing the Americans were these brutal people that would torture and murder them, and that it would be better if they committed suicide than be captured by the Americans. So many of them did that. They took their own lives, took the lives of their family members. Others, as the battle went on, they wanted to surrender. They wanted to go to the American side. Americans had set up these great, I wouldn't say great, but set up these military camps behind the lines for the civilians, places to house and feed them and everything. So they would try to infiltrate the American lines and get to those places. Trouble was the Japanese soldiers were often with them, and they would use them as shields, dress in kimonos that would cover their weapons, and then push them toward the American lines. American soldiers would see the Japanese behind them, and they were forced to just open fire. They'd kill everybody. And this went on day after day. And many of the civilians just hid in caves. Unfortunately, they were often with Japanese soldiers in these caves. And so they were wiped out with the Japanese. The Americans realized that they were just killing so many civilians in these caves. So instead of throwing phosphorus grenades into the caves, they started throwing smoke grenades just to flush them out so they could take them into custody.
Wow. So you got, week after week of this incredibly bloody carnage, but the Americans are making progress and pushing the Japanese toward the southern part of the island. And, the Americans are realizing that we're heading towards the end of the battle here. But General Buckner doesn't get to see that. Can you tell us what happened with him?
Yeah, the Japanese had retreated from the Shuri line to the final line, which is on the Kaiyan Peninsula. And he had gone down there to observe some of the action. And 4 days before the island was declared secured, an artillery round or a mortar round hit near where he was watching the action and sprayed him with coral fragments and shrapnel. And he died on the spot. And he was the highest ranking U.S. general killed during World War II. His father was a Confederate Army general. So you can see World War II wasn't that far removed from the Civil War,
Right. Yeah, and also in those last days on the Japanese side, you've got Ushijima issuing orders for his soldiers not to commit suicide, but to fight to the very end, to try to take out as many of the Americans as possible. But that order didn't seem to apply to him.
No, it didn't. He took his own life, and so did his chief of staff. They committed suicide right at the very end. They were in the headquarters key. It was right at the southern tip of the island. Americans were closing in, and they committed ritual suicide just before dawn one day as they looked out over the sea.
So then, you know, after Buckner's death, you've got, you know, the interim commander taking charge and declares the end of the battle there, and then that organized resistance has been wiped out. And so that's the end of the, you know, battle for Okinawa, and it proves to be the final battle of the war, but of course the people fighting it didn't know that at the time. How did the whole experience influence plans for the invasion of Japan?
Well, it went forward as the battle ended. There was something like 100,000 construction troops building stuff on the island. Barracks, overhauling the airstrips, new ports. The roads were all paved. It was incredible. And some of the troops that had been fighting in the south, when they came up to near where the landing beaches had been, they were just amazed. It was totally different.
Yeah, you talk about you know, some of the muddy paths that they were coming down south to fight, and on their way back, it was, you know, highways with MPs dressed in khakis directing traffic.
Directing traffic, yes. It had really changed. But the end of the fighting didn't really thrill anybody because they knew they were going to have to invade Japan, and it would be probably a lot worse than what they'd just been through. So there wasn't a real spirit of jubilation when the battle ended. That didn't come until Japan surrendered in August.
Right, following the atomic bombs dropping on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, assumed that you know, the bloody experience of Okinawa was a factor in Truman's decision on what to do, right?
No, that's right, yeah. When they were meeting, he just gloomily predicted that invading Japan would be Okinawa's from one end to the other. So it certainly influenced the decision to drop bombs, right? There's no doubt.
All right, so, you know, in the end, you've got Okinawa as the largest battle and the bloodiest battle and the final battle of the Pacific, but it was been overshadowed by other events at the time. How should we remember it today?
I think we should remember it actually for what it was and how this was a battle that probably pushed us more than anything into using nuclear weapons against Japan. So it's significant in that respect. It brought us within 350 miles of Japan, mainland Japan. And we could have just bombed from Okinawa. Because before we secured Okinawa, the B-29s were flying from Tinian. And it was about a 1,500-mile haul to Tokyo one way. So they would be in the air for possibly 12 hours. Now, Okinawa would have made it a lot better. But I think that's probably the significance of it, was that it pushed us. It was so terrible that it pushed us into using nuclear weapons.
Well, certainly a sobering legacy for us all to reflect upon.
And what's interesting is we're still there, 7,000 people there, yeah.
And majority of our bases in Japan are still on the island, is that correct?
That's right, yeah.
All right, well, I want to thank you, Joseph Whelan, for being our guest on the podcast, and to remind all the listeners that his new book is Bloody Okinawa, The Last Great Battle of World War II.
To all our listeners, thanks for joining us. Be sure to subscribe to the Army Matters podcast on iTunes and everywhere podcasts are found. Join us next Monday for a special edition of Army Matters. The Army Matters podcast series is brought to you by the Association of the United States Army, the U.S. Army's professional association, member-supported, Army-connected. Visit us at AUSA.org for more information or to become a member. Your membership helps AUSA continue to carry out its mission to educate, inform, and connect with the total Army, our industry partners, and our supporters of a strong national defense. For questions or to provide topic recommendations, email us at podcast@AUSA.org. Have a great Army Day. Hooah.